Well, we've been hearing about the chaos that has returned to parts of Syria under attack by Turkish forces. And one of the big issues has been the escape of a great number of ISIS fighters from a camp at Ain Issa. Now, here in Australia, concerns have been raised about the safety of the 50 or 60 Australian women and children who were mostly in a camp at Al Hol. The government has been reluctant to rescue them, and are no doubt even more reluctant given the current situation. Now, one woman who knows a lot about the women in the camps in Syria is our next guest. Azadeh Moovani has written a book about the women who joined ISIS from all over the world. Journalist, author, academic, been on the program before, back in 2005 when we talked about her book Lipstick Jihad, about her life in America as an Iranian and her life in Iran as an American. The latest book is called Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS, and it's published by our comrades at Scribe. And she joins us on The Blower from London. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
When you decided to set out on this saga, what did you expect the women to be like? What were you anticipating?
I imagined that they would all be, by and large, and I think I had been quite, I think, conditioned by the news coverage of ISIS, that they would be very devout, very pious, unrelatable, very rigid ideologically. That they would be very indoctrinated, and that they would come from, you know, a kind of swathe of society that would be to me unfathomable. Because I think that's so much of how ISIS has been covered in the media in the West, is just a product of religion. And so we think that its adherents must just be blind religious zealots. And then when I set out on this research in the course of the book, I think that was the first most spectacularly astonishing thing, was the variety of women who, through lots of different frustrations, desires, delusions, from all different backgrounds, educated, upper class, lower class, cosmopolitan, provincial, studying for marketing degrees, all different backgrounds.
All individuals, rather than some amorphous group of monsters. But are there monsters amongst them?
Indeed, yes. I think we must acknowledge that. I mean, the group became in the end a genocidal project that embraced, you know, at least at the highest levels, you know, the enslavement of certain populations. It was highly sectarian. And we know through court cases that there are women who, you know, we have the evidence of women who participated in these kind of crimes that are quite heinous. I do think that it's especially now, as you said, as you introduced our conversation, as the West confronts what to do with these women, the fact that they are such a diverse kind of group, that they're real kind of victims amongst them, interspersed with the monsters, and so many children, that looking at that nuance and kind of understanding, so many of them, you know, were very young girls when they were recruited by ISIS and really groomed, I think, you know, the language we use for gangs.
How young?
The youngest girls whose story I encountered were 13 and 14 when they first started being recruited. In lots of milieus, this was something that ISIS did really effectively. It definitely targeted very young women, idealistic teenagers, girls from broken homes, teenagers who, you know, I worked a lot in Tunisia, who were kind of coming of age in a very restive, you know, Tunisia at that moment. I think a big part of this story is that we're looking at places in the Middle East that were in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, you know, a time when women were really involved in those protests, and young women especially had come out, their consciousness was awakened, and they were quite idealistic. They thought that these revolutions had so much hope and promise, and when a lot of them kind of took a dark turn, they were very much ripe to be recruited or preyed upon by ISIS, which presented itself as an alternative to what the Arab Spring revolutions failed to deliver.
Well, the book makes it clear that these, as you say, are profoundly different women. But were there perhaps some common threads?
I certainly think one common thread amongst, you know, women from London, from Europe, from other countries, was a feeling of exclusion, whether it was feeling kind of alienated and confused in terms of identity. There were a lot of second generation Muslim women from immigrant families who didn't really feel quite British, quite Pakistani or Bangladeshi. They felt very out of place. They felt excluded from, you know, this idea of citizenship that they thought kind of didn't apply to them if they wore headscarves and were quite religious. Young women in parts of the Arab world who felt excluded from pathways to politics because, of course, they were coming from countries that were politically so repressive. So I think in lots of ways, personal, political, you know, young women who kind of tried to access education in their countries and struggled because some of those authoritarian countries were so fiercely opposed to letting women who even covered their hair go to university. So I think exclusion was a theme across kind of all of these milieus.
Tell me about Asma, who was a Syrian linked living in Raqqa.
Asma was a young woman that I met when I initially went on the trail of those three schoolgirls from London who became kind of a global story for having joined ISIS. It was so inexplicable. And then Asma was a young woman. She had grown up in Raqqa, between Raqqa and Damascus. She was studying marketing. She was quite cosmopolitan, really. I mean, she read Dan Brown novels, she read English novels, she was on social media, she didn't cover her hair, she wanted to work in tourism. And, you know, she was living in Raqqa when ISIS took over her hometown. And like so many families who didn't have the means to leave or perhaps felt, you know, that they should just try and stick it out there, her family ended up collaborating with ISIS. And eventually, because it was kind of like a mafia, the only force in town, she ended up working with them. And her job was to kind of ferry women from the border because she had some English. She ferried these women arriving from Europe, from the border into Raqqa. And in the end, she defected. She escaped. And I met her when she had fled ISIS. But to me, she kind of epitomized, you know, this you know, the most unexpected face, you know, a young woman, outward looking, independent, her life before her, who was caught up in this chain of events, you know, this terrible conflict that had beset her country, even though she had no allegiance to it at all.
Tell me about Noura and the part and her life in Tunisia.
Noor, I start the book with Noor, and her story stays with me, maybe the most indelibly amongst them. Noor was a 13-year-old. She was growing up, and her story starts in Tunisia before its Arab Spring Revolution. So in an era where it was very authoritarian, fiercely authoritarian state, mostly secular. I think we understand it as a secular dictatorship in those times, which meant that women who were visibly religious, who covered their hair, weren't allowed to go to school. So Noor, a 13-year-old, decides she wants to wear a headscarf because she's become an adolescent, and that's what, you know, many young women do from conservative religious backgrounds. So she shows up at school wearing her headscarf, and she puts on a face veil too because she had been persuaded that that's what was required of her. And her teachers are furious. One of them slaps her. She's thrown out of school. She's suspended for 10 days. And in the end, she drops out. And she's kind of, you know, young woman growing up at a time when there was not a lot of access to public life as a religious young woman in that kind of secular dictatorship, or a dictatorship that really, I say, micro-police people's piety. So Noor, in the aftermath of the revolution, suddenly thought, wow, there's a massive corrective. You know, now there's going to be freedom and I can be a religious activist and I can participate in politics. And that's what she got swept up in. There was a kind of wave of that kind of activism. And you know, not to go into too much detail on what's a really Tunisian political story, but there was a turn in which, you know, the most radical, fierce, young, idealistic people of that revolution, taking advantage of the freedom that became possible after the Arab Spring Revolution, got swept up in a very violent turn and were recruited very heavily by ISIS. So, you know, her husband joined and she thought that, you know, that was the only pathway for her.
Now, there's no simple answer in terms of what should happen to the women in the camps, is there?
No, there is not. And you know, mostly politicians are very much guided by short-term interests, whether it's fear of their public sentiment has, you know, understandably to some extent has no sympathy for these women. And politicians are so fearful of, you know, allowing someone back, repatriating women, and then, you know, one of them committing a crime on their watch, you know, it would have such a devastating political consequences. So the horizon is very short term and largely political, I think, for governments. I mean, there are so many humanitarian concerns. A lot of these women have many children. You know, legally, their right to be able to access legal services, to expect the support of their government is, I think, a real compelling issue. But I think ultimately governments are making short-term political calculations.
Do you believe that foreign fighters should be returned to their home countries and face the legal consequences of their actions?
So this is a very tricky question. Certainly they should face the legal consequences of their actions, but in many instances, there isn't a lot of evidence on which to prosecute them for all sorts of reasons. It's who knows what someone was doing in some rural Syrian village, even if maybe they committed war crimes, maybe some of the evidence is not permissible. So the reality is that, you know, according to many of these countries, our country's legal systems, it would be very tough to prosecute them for the length of time that, you know, we intuit should be expected for things they've been involved in. At the same time, leaving them out there in the long term is a security risk of its own, because we've seen how ISIS germinated in these prisons in Iraq. We see how this kind of, you know, transnational jihadism cultivates itself in these kind of fetid detention centers that are, you know, that where they're being held. So it's there are really no good solutions to this situation, because bringing them back and prosecuting them is a challenge. Leaving them out there is a longer term security risk. And I think the difficulty is we've never really faced anything like this before, this kind of massive movement of people across the world to join a caliphate. And all of our legal systems, our criminal justice systems, are not quite equipped to deal with what's come out of it. So certainly they need to be prosecuted. But I think it's a challenge. How do we do that without kind of, you know, trampling our own values about what due process is and what rule of law is? But I think leaving them out there, you know, creating, you know, future Guantanamos that jihadist groups can use to then, you know, message and radicalize people over is not the answer either.
Did any of the women have a positive experience during their time with ISIS that they would admit to?
That's such an interesting question. No, I would say. I mean, many of them, there were some who said, you know, at the very beginning, maybe for 2 months, I thought, especially the ones who went very early before the really grotesque theatrical violence started, said, you know, at the very beginning, I thought that we were building this utopian religious society, and I thought I would have, you know, a role here. But I think, you know, all of that crashed down very quickly. They saw that, you know, it was such a cruel imposition on women, that if their husbands died, they would have to marry over and over again, that if they tried to escape, they would be abused, they would have their children taken away. You know, even women who I spoke to that were really quite devout and ideological, you know, I think acknowledged that it had still been, you know, involved terrible suffering for them. So no, I mean, I think it became really a grotesquerie for almost everyone I spoke to.
You admit in the book that you empathize with the women you interviewed, and you can understand some of their motivations. You say it could have been me, but of course it wasn't you. You didn't follow that path. Why not?
I mean, what I had in common with them is, you know, I too grew up in a second generation family of Middle Eastern background, kind of raised on this idea that Western intervention and Western policies in the Middle East were exploitative, that the West's media narrative about Islam was racist, that it was based on a kind of system of exploitation. So, like, I came from the living room culture that ISIS really exploited when it was targeting a lot of these young women. You know, it didn't come to them saying, come join a genocide project. It came to them saying, look at Guantanamo, look at your society's racism, look at how refugees are treated. You know, it manipulated all those themes. And I, you know, if I had been very young, I think I would have been attuned to that. I think You know, I came from a family that was also attentive. It was westernized. I think a lot of these parents of these young girls didn't know how to parent in the West. They often came from rural backgrounds in Pakistan, Bangladesh. They were very conservative. They were very working class. So these girls were not in home milieus where if they were angry at the West or upset about Western foreign policy, there was no one there saying, why don't you become a foreign correspondent or why don't you study human rights law? I don't think that there were parents attuned to see that they were being groomed and were suddenly changing in their behavior, because I think the parents were quite checked out. They thought, oh, so our young girls are dressing more conservatively, spending more time at the mall. I mean, they all.
A final question. Have you been to the camp at Ain Issa?
Yes, yes. I was in Ain Issa right after Raqqa fell. And so many women and children fled at the earliest opportunity. A lot of them were, I think, women who were desperate to flee and got out as soon as they could. And it was a terrible place, you know, rampant with disease and so much tension between civilians who had been brutalized under ISIS. And I spent time there with women from Tunisia, from France, from Germany, who really had really tragic, terrible stories. I think a lot of those women ended up going back because, you know, a lot of countries have taken their ISIS citizens back. But that camp doesn't exist anymore now because, you know, the Turkish invasion has meant that, you know, our Kurdish allies, the West, the coalition's Kurdish allies who were guarding Ain Issa, you know, it came under shelling and they all ran away. So we're in a situation where the allies we depended on to guard all of these women, amongst them, as we've said, you know, very dangerous women and many victims have got to go the fight, their own fight. So Ain Issa doesn't exist. And now the question is whether the really big camp that's called Al Hol that holds 70,000 people, 13,000 of them from the West, and that's where the Australians that you mentioned are being held, you know, will that hold too? Or will that fall under the hands of the Syrian government? Or, you know, will all those people disperse as well? We don't know.
The book is A Guest House for Young Widows, Among the Women of ISIS. The author, Zaida Mouvani.